Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Ninth Circuit. We're happy to be here. I'm happy to be sitting with my colleagues, Judge McEwen and Judge Sanchez. We have a number of matters this morning that have been submitted on the briefs. I will quickly just recite the case names, and then we'll get to the argued cases. So we have Kumar versus McHenry, Singh versus McHenry, Perez versus McHenry, Borges de Alameda versus McHenry, Ochoa Gairon versus McHenry, Diniz versus McHenry, Lara Gomez versus McHenry, and Singh versus McHenry. That leaves us with two argued cases for the day. The first one will be Doe et al. Versus Twitter. And I think we have counsel ready at table. So I would just remind counsel that the time showing on your clock is your complete time. And so we'll start with Mr. Gantala.
Good morning, Your Honor. Peter Gentala for the appellants, John Doe number one and John Doe number two. And I would like to respectfully request to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, watch your time and we'll try to give you a cue.
Thank you, Judge Forrest. This is a case about Twitter's actual knowledge and its overt acts and its decision to possess and benefit from illegal child pornography. This court should reverse the district court for three reasons. First, under the plain text of Section 230 and this court's precedents, neither the child pornography claim or the benefiting from sex trafficking claim treats Twitter like a publisher or speaker. Second, on these alleged facts, Twitter is beyond the protections of Section 230 because it has materially contributed to the illegality of the child pornography in this case. And third, Twitter's unreasonably dangerous product design is not shielded by Section 230. Turning to the Trafficking Victims Protection Act or the benefiting from sex trafficking claim, it's important for this court to understand that it is hearing it now as a matter of first impression. In the prior interlocutory appeal, this claim brought up, but the question there was, should it be remanded in light of the Reddit decision, which had been handed down while that interlocutory appeal was pending? This court did elect in its memorandum decision to remand to the district court, and the district court then turned to it. The district court never took into consideration the standard under the Barnes test, and most recently, this court's decision in Calise, where this court explained that in order to understand whether a claim is covered by Section 230, first you have to look at the legal duty that each claim would apply.
Counsel, who sought the request for interlocutory review the last go-around?
Judge Sanchez, it was originally sought by Twitter, reviewing just the benefiting from sex trafficking claim, and then there was a cross appeal that brought in the other claims as well.
So plaintiffs as well. I was on that panel from before, and my understanding was that the interlocutory questions presumed that that Section 230 immunity applied, and the questions were related to the FOSTA exception. Does law of the case bar you now from arguing that that Section 230 immunity should not apply?
Judge Sanchez, this is not with regard to the benefit. There's two parts to that. First, benefiting from sex trafficking, that claim is not covered by law of the case because the Reddit decision itself never addresses whether Section 230 should apply in the first instance, because both parties in that case decided that Section 230, they conceded that Section 230 applied and treated Reddit as a publisher and a speaker. In this case, neither the district court nor this court has ever taken up the first step in the analysis, which is, does the legal duty of benefiting from sex trafficking apply? And then with regard to the child pornography claim, that one was directly ruled on in the interlocutory appeal, as you know, and we're coming back, and we think that the law of this circuit has been clarified significantly by the Calise case, and that was the exact language that the Calise panel chose to use. It noted that there had been some question about the scope of 230's protections, and it said that the goal of the opinion there was to clarify it, and the first step in clarifying it was to focus on Barnes and to focus on the actual legal duty test.
Well, so then assuming law of the case doesn't bar you from bringing these issues up, why isn't Twitter being treated as a publisher or speaker, or rather as a publisher in these claims? If it essentially boils down to whether Twitter failed to take steps to remove the CSAM content from its platform.
Two parts to that, Judge Sanchez, and really we have to take each claim separately. It can't be the same answer for both claims. They deserve independent consideration under the Calise decision. With regard to the Trafficking Victims Protection Act or the benefiting, the legal duty there was Twitter's duty to not knowingly benefit from participation in a trafficking venture and to not knowingly disregard the likelihood that a child will be engaged in a commercial sex act. Here, from the record, we know for certain that Twitter knew that the plaintiffs were children. That's paragraphs 114 and 121 of the amended complaint. Twitter knew that child pornography was created through coercion, paragraph 114. Twitter knew that the pictures were created through a coercive process, in addition to paragraph 114, that's paragraph 119. And Twitter reviewed and then wrote an email to John Doe number one, confirming its review. That's paragraph 120. So armed with that knowledge, Twitter then decided to continue profiting from the child pornography, and that constitutes benefiting from sex trafficking. Then with regard to the child pornography claim, on the other side, the fundamental duty there is Twitter's duty, once it knows that it is in possession of child pornography, to not continue to possess it. And we know that it did exactly that because in paragraph 120, it confirmed to John Doe number one, we have reviewed the content. It's going to stay on our website at this time. And it did stay up on the website for another 7 days after that. And as a result, it was distributed to untold thousands of people.
Well, let's stick with the first claim about for beneficial liability. If, you know, I think Twitter's argument is Reddit covers much of the same factual allegations, and the court there said turning a blind eye isn't enough to create a beneficial liability. So how do you distinguish Reddit's factual circumstances from your own?
Well, it's not just a blind eye. It's the actual possession of the illegal images in the first place. This is not a blind eye situation.
Well,
this
it's not just knowing that there's material on the website, as I think Reddit also knew and only at times took down. It's knowingly participating in this trafficking venture in some kind of way, something more proactive than just not doing enough to take it down. That's, as I read Reddit, the import of it. And so I have a tough time seeing how to distinguish those facts from your own.
Thank you for that, Judge Sanchez. This is not a failure to take down or failure to monitor the platform case. This is not a situation where we're expecting all platforms to do a perfect job of reviewing what they have out there and prevent these things from going up or to take them down under a certain time frame. This is that unusual case where the platform itself has confirmed in writing when it reviewed the child pornography and communicated to the trafficked person that it had intended to allow that illegal image to stay on its platform.
So how is that distinguished from Reddit? Because in Reddit, we summarized the allegations that the plaintiff failed to remove the pornography when it was alleged, even when users reported it. So Reddit had knowledge. Why isn't that the same in this case in terms of the allegations?
Two things in response to that, Judge McEwen. First, the knowledge that we're talking about in this case is actual knowledge of the specific image. Twitter wrote back and said, we have reviewed the image that you sent to us, and we have decided it doesn't violate our policies. It's going to stay up on the platform. The second thing is that the Reddit case only deals with the benefiting from sex trafficking claim. I understand that the factual predicate for the whole thing was
it's
child pornography.
I mean, it all stems from the same foundation, though, doesn't it, in Reddit?
Respectfully, Judge McEwen, it stems from the same factual foundation, but under Section 230, each claim has to be reviewed independently. And the point I'd like to make about Reddit with regard to the child pornography claim is that that claim was not before the court, and so it doesn't constitute a holding of the court with regard to 2252A.
I know you're arguing that on the possession of child pornography claim, that was a clearly erroneous decision by the last panel, but aren't we bound by a decision by a prior three-judge panel? Wouldn't this have to be taken up by an en banc court instead? What leeway would we have to reverse a decision on the merits made by a prior three-judge panel?
Well, Judge Sanchez, I don't think... With regard to the benefiting claim, we're not talking about moving in a different direction.
No, I'm talking about the child pornography possession claim.
Thank you, Judge Sanchez. With regard to the child pornography claim, we submit that the Calise case, which came down afterwards and clarified the standards, showed what the legal duty has to be. And there was no assessment in the prior memorandum decision in this case of the actual application of a child pornography claim. So let's apply the legal duty test. What's the legal duty? To not knowingly possess child pornography. And that's exactly what Twitter confirmed in its own words that it did here. Again, this is that unusual case prior to there being any discovery in the case whatsoever. We're just on the alleged facts itself. You have the platform confirming its actual knowledge. And I see my time is running out. I just want to make clear that we are making a material contribution argument as well under the roommate's decision, and I'm happy to address that later on rebuttal or if you have any questions.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think you should turn to the product liability case a little bit, because that's a claim that we're interested in hearing about more as well.
All right.
Thank you, Judge. Well, so the product liability is you apply the legal duty test, and the duty there is to have a safe product that is not harming anyone. And here we have specific allegations in the record that Twitter has a search suggestion feature. So it's directly in the complaint. The search comes in for a hashtag that's very common for child pornography, like megalinks. And Twitter uses its platform to say, would you like to search instead for megalinks young, something that would pinpoint even more child pornography. So what's happening with the way this platform is structured is it's not just a meeting place for people who would trade child pornography. It's structured in a way so that it's actually a marketplace. And with that, I'd like to reserve the balance.
I think the design defect is a little bit more complicated. There's three different aspects that you allege. And the one I'm interested in is the duty to report, because it does seem to me that potentially that has a different foundation than your other ones about failure to block and the search features like hashtags, which the hashtag might fall into the Dyruff case. But talk to me, if you will, about the reporting and why you think that would survive dismissal.
Judge McEwen, I think that clearly the reporting side of things, when you have a platform, that you have a standard out there that all platforms are supposed to report child pornography as soon as possible. That's 18 U.S.C. 2258 A and B. And so if you look at paragraph 186 in our amended complaint, there's insufficient safeguards there to ensure that the child pornography would be quickly reported to the legal authorities and to the National Center on Missing and Exploited Children. And all the proof you need of that is paragraph 120, where Twitter says, we've reviewed child pornography and it's going to stay on our website. Thank you. I'd like to reserve the balance.
Let me ask you this. Is the duty to report, I know there's the statutory duty to report, but does that create a private right of action for someone to file a claim over the failure to report?
No, Judge, not, and that claim is not before the court, but I took Judge McEwen's question how the product design integrates
with that. But it seems as if the product design claim is a variation of seeking enforcement on Twitter's failure to have reported this material to the necessary authorities. And I'm wondering if you can do that, if that's a different way of basically asking for enforcement of the statute.
That is one of the unsafe elements of this platform, the way it ties into safe reporting. But there's other things like the hashtags and the safe, the search suggestion features as well. So that the product liability claim does not turn just on reporting, but that is an important aspect of it.
Well, I'm sure we'll get a little bit more time, but it seems to me that the reporting aspect, or your claim is that there's a design defect in effect, that the way the platform is designed, that that's distinguishable from the hashtag aspect. And following up on my earlier question, with respect to hashtags and not the reporting aspect, isn't that covered by Section 230 immunity under DIROF?
Judge McEwen, no, it's not under DIROF. I think if you look closely at DIROF, it's talking about the blank box scenario, where someone can actually put their comments in there. And so there's two parts to it. Here, Twitter is actually taking what is put in the box and saying, oh, did you mean to look for a younger image, perhaps? That's something that's unsafe that's in the product design. And the second part is, in DIROF, again, this was a platform that allowed people to communicate with each other anonymously, to link up. And here we're saying that the overall platform design is allowing there to be an actual marketplace for child pornography.
Thank you.
So your ineffective reporting system product defect theory, is that focused on an ineffective system allowing users to report to Twitter or for Twitter to report to authorities?
Judge Forrest, it would be both. It'd be both. Now, the reporting to Twitter actually happened clearly, and Twitter issued a timely response. We've reviewed the child pornography. We're going to keep it up on the platform. But what it failed to do was to turn around and to notify the authorities that they had the contraband.
So then by that answer, it sort of seems like it's more the latter, the Twitter reporting to authorities than the user reporting to Twitter. Is your theory for why the product is defective?
On the facts of this case with regard to the reporting function of the platform, that's certainly what happened.
If we're taking you over because we're interested, if there's a defect in the way that Twitter has organized its reporting mechanism to Twitter, does Twitter have a duty once a report has been filed by someone that you have this material on here to take it down, or does that carry over into immunity as a publisher?
I think the latter, Judge Sanchez, and in this case, there was a report that one of the accounts that was sending out this child pornography was sending out child pornography, and that report actually came in before the report from my clients came in, and just flagging this account to watch it. Twitter didn't do anything with that. But it's not that general duty in the first instance to police the platform and to have reporting be part of it. In this case, Twitter didn't just sit on the report. It followed up on the report, and then reviewed the child pornography, and then made the overt decision that it was going to stay on its platform.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll give you time for a rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Derek Schaefer on behalf of X Corporation. Your Honors, plaintiffs in this appeal are bidding to overturn the law of the case, circuit precedent, and the congressional policy judgment embodied in Section 230. Our modest submission here is simply that settled law should hold for reasons Your Honors have well and repeatedly articulated. And I'd start, Your Honors, just at the Section 1591 claim, participation in sex trafficking. And I would just note, Judge Sanchez, to answer your question about the law of the case, we think the law of the case does establish that Section 230 applies here categorically. The grounds for the interlocutory appeal by my client was that there was a controlling question of law as to whether the magistrate judge had been too lenient in applying the FOSTA exception. And so it would come down basically to what Reddit decided and what was decided on remand. And the plaintiffs agreed with that. They agreed with that. That's how the interlocutory appeal came before the court. So then implicit in the question that was posed and what this court was answering is that the analysis of whether there was a valid claim would depend upon whether the FOSTA exception was satisfied in accordance with Reddit. That's the law of the case.
Well, there's two ways to look at that, of course, is it's implicit in the overall interlocutory appeal. But did the court actually decide that or just assume with respect to that?
I'd say in between, Judge McEwen, I think it was stipulated by the parties, and so there was no dispute as to whether this would be what it came down to. But the law of the circuit is equally clear, we think. Reddit did say
that
the
may
same
be
thing.
The better argument is that Reddit says what Reddit says.
I'll go with that one. And so you have the law of the circuit in addition to the law of the case. But then I also think, Judge McEwen, even in the first instance, you have the statutory law from Congress. You have FOSTA. The reason that Congress passed FOSTA was to specify in what limited circumstances allegations like these could establish that there was active participation in sex trafficking such that Section 230 would not hold. With all due respect for plaintiff's argument here, it renders FOSTA meaningless because they say whenever there are allegations like these, you're outside of Section 230. That just can't be right, and you have it from Congress. And I would note, Your Honors, that the theory of participation in the venture here, there is no such participation other than because X Corporation allegedly permitted third-party uploading for publication. That's exactly where Section 230 does its work, to protect against liability when you have that sort of a theory. And then, Your Honors, it brings me to whether the district court was correct to say that Section 1591 is not satisfied. And again, Judge McEwen, Reddit did decide that. Reddit did decide in exactly the portions that Your Honor was citing. You can find it at 51 F4th at 1145-46. This court was clear about what would have to be concretely alleged in order to establish affirmative participation in a sex trafficking venture. And those allegations were materially indistinguishable from those here. You can see where we go through it in the red brief at 28 to 32, where we explain how the Reddit allegations were of a piece with those here. And my friend, Mr. Giantala, says, well, Reddit wasn't as specific in its allegations. Your Honors, Reddit was a class action. So it was all of these plaintiffs who were alleging that there had been content, offending content, that was uploaded and reported to Reddit, and Reddit either would not take it down or it would take it down temporarily and then allow it to come back. And those allegations were categorically insufficient to state a valid claim, and that's why the complaint was altogether dismissed. It wasn't a remand for those plaintiffs to replead any specifics along the lines of what Mr. Giantala says would make, you know, the outcome determinative difference. And I think that reasoning is right, Your Honors. I could elaborate on why, but let me just make one simple point. An image does not equate with a person, as Judge Sanchez, the prior panel, made clear, and the plaintiffs are conflating different crimes. We'll talk separately about the child pornography allegations, but these allegations are that years after heinous acts by other actors who never had anything to do with Twitter convinced the Doe plaintiffs to create certain images of themselves, years after that, someone else, not the traffickers, uploaded to the Twitter platform the offending images. That is not trafficking of a person, and certainly there was nothing that Twitter allegedly did with the alleged sex trafficking venture that had completed years before any of the allegations concerning Twitter. And so, Your Honors, with that, I would just turn briefly to the CSAM allegations, which are about the images. And their plaintiff's theory is that any such images, because they are offending images, are not protected by Section 230. And, Your Honors, that cannot be right. The law of the case is directly on point. This prior panel said that when you have these sorts of allegations, perforce, Section 230 applies. There was a denial of rehearing when plaintiffs sought it, on the same theory they're urging here, without any judge on this court calling for a vote. There is no circuit split on this point. I know my friends cite the Caliste case, but Caliste is not speaking to this question of whether CSAM, by virtue of being CSAM, is outside of Section 230. And my last point, Your Honors, is any different result would flout the congressional intent by exposing internet providers to liability any time a third party allegedly uploads illegal content to other to the websites in question. Here, plaintiffs are saying, well, CSAM can't qualify as information, but you could say the same thing about defamation. You could say the same thing about obscenity. You could say if this is illegal content and it's on a website and the website knows or should know that it's on there, Section 230 isn't applicable. That's antithetical to to what Congress meant to establish in Section 230 and also on the wrong side of this court's precedent.
I recall the last time that I heard this claim that there were differing views at the district court level. Has any circuit court weighed in on this issue?
The Fifth Circuit, in an unpublished opinion, Judge Sanchez, has agreed with you. That's all I have from a circuit court, to the best of my knowledge.
Okay.
Now I'll get to the product liability claims. And, Your Honors, respectfully, we think that this is just as easy. It falls within the teeth of Section 230 because the duties that we're talking about when it comes to the product liability, negligent design theory, those are duties associated with, quote, mass dissemination, close quote. I'm quoting the plaintiff's brief on page 38. You can see the same on-point allegations in three excerpts of record 450, paragraph 179 of the First Amendment complaint. The reason that these duties apply is because X Corporation has a lot of content on its platform that, according to the allegations, reaches a lot of different viewers very quickly. Those are the duties that follow from publishing. And the theory of harm, Your Honors, is all about dissemination of content to the public, with the harm arising from failure to quote this court in Barnes, to depublish. Plaintiff's harm arose for exactly the reason that Mr. Gentile is saying. They wanted this content to come down from a website so it wouldn't be published for others to see. That's why plaintiffs were harmed. Of course, I understand that theory. I understand why they are aggrieved. But that sort of a grievance is exactly what Section 230 says is not available against the internet provider.
Why does that line of argument work on the ineffective reporting system theory?
So, Judge Forrest, I think there may be a little bit of conflation of two distinct theories. One was a theory of product design, and the allegation is because of the hashtags and because of algorithms and so forth, certain popular content would be especially available on Twitter. That's the product, what I understand to be the product design theory. Mr. Gentile may stand up and correct me in rebuttal. But then there's a separate theory based upon the failure to report statutorily, and that the reporting to the federal government did not happen soon enough consistent with Twitter's statutory responsibilities, and the allegation there is that's negligence per se because of failure to comply with the statute.
I understand that, but frankly, I'm confused by something that your friend across the aisle said in his argument, but I'm looking at the complaint, and it says in paragraph 182, Twitter is not designed to enable its users to easily report CSAM, nor is it designed so that CSAM is immediately blocked. So that first point, pending review, so that first point about designed to enable users to easily report, why does your theory about that's all about being a publisher, why does that work?
I think it does, Judge Forrest, because you could say that if it's defamation, you could say there was false content that was on the website and you didn't have a product that was designed to take it down quickly enough. You could say the same thing about obscenity. You could say the same thing about hate speech.
But having a reporting system so users can tell the platform what's going on doesn't automatically mean that anything is going to happen in terms of editing the content on the platform.
But Judge Forrest, as this court held in Barnes and as actually the Fifth Circuit said in the Salesforce case that's been reported by the plaintiffs on 28J, the question for Section 230 purposes is, if this claim were sustained, what would a defendant have to do differently? And the answer to that, Judge Forrest, is they would absolutely, to satisfy these plaintiffs and avoid the harm to these plaintiffs and avoid the liability, they would have to take the content down. Because no matter, Mr. Gentile is here emphasizing that what is so distinctive about these claims is it was reported, it was registered, and what's the problem, Judge Forrest? It was not taken down.
Well, I'm having some trouble in terms of distinguishing among the two or three design defect products liability claims. So I want to focus on the one that I asked your opposing counsel about and also that Judge Forrest talks about. So the designing a system for reporting, it seems to me, is not the same as acting as a publisher. And so on that score, we have this Lemon v. Snap case.
Yes.
Talk to us about why Lemon v. Snap doesn't apply, because Lemon v. Snap was one of the rare cases that says no Section 230 liability.
Judge McEwen, I want to talk about that, but let me offer one observation at the outset, which is the theory of harm here is absolutely that the content needed to be taken down and was not taken down. So ultimately, the box that plaintiffs go through for that is the depublishing box. And what I mean, Judge McEwen, is it is not relevant to plaintiffs' damage here. If they, and it is not relevant even to their causal chain if there was some issue with the product not enabling reporting, because Mr. Dentala is emphasizing this was reported to X, it was registered by X, and the alleged failing by X, the rubber meets road difference, was the failure to take the content down. But with that, let me turn to the Lemon case. In Lemon, it is not a failure of content moderation. As you say, that's the rare case where Section 230 does not apply. And what you had was a product that was designed by Snap itself. It was a product that, as the court explained, ostensibly had rewards tied to it. So they said to users, or suggested to users, they would be rewarded for reporting high speeds. And the issue is not the world is seeing certain content and it's embarrassing or it's damaging to a plaintiff. The theory was you are, through your product, encouraging people, the actual user on the other end of that screen, to do something that is unsafe as to them. It was classic product liability and totally removed from the content moderation issues that are all about whether third-party content is being removed or shown to others who a plaintiff says should not be seeing that.
I mean, it's not totally removed, because part of the incentive in the Snap case was seeing content of other people in undertaking these speeding activities that would then say, well, let me try this as well. So, you know, there's a little bit of an overlay between those two issues, don't you think?
I credit your point, Judge Sanchez. I understand that overlap, but I still stand on the distinctness, which is that the Snap plaintiff is a user who says, you are telling me through, or you are changing my conduct through a product of yours, and that is how you are harming me. I am using your Snap product, which is different from saying you have images out there that are damaging to me and you are showing them to the world. You have third-party content that you're allowing to stay on your platform and you're not adequately moderating that content. This is the prototypical Section 230 case, and I credit Judge McEwen's characterization. I think Snap is the rare case that falls outside.
So I take it then your argument is on the reporting side that even if there's some alleged defect in users being able to notify Twitter of this, they couldn't establish any damages from the harm because the ultimate causal link in between is that Twitter didn't take that content down, which then makes it a publisher case.
That's right, Judge Sanchez. And also, this court has been clear, the Fifth Circuit has been clear, all courts have been clear, you can't overcome Section 230 through artful pleading. And I mean no aspersions on my learned and impressive colleagues for the other side, but I think at best it would be artful pleading for them to say, oh, the issue is a failure to report content to Twitter, that's the product defect, when in fact their ultimate theory of harm is Twitter should have been depublishing the content or not publishing it in the first place. That's what caused their harm.
That's their big concern, but that's potentially, this is a carve-out from that concern, isn't it?
I don't think so.
They don't necessarily need the same remedy on each of their design defect claims.
But they need an injury, and they need proximate causation, and I just don't see how...
But couldn't you have the claim fail for lack of proof on that requirement as opposed to immunity?
Well, it could be a lack of... I think Your Honors could decide it on reasons, on grounds outside of Section 230, the lack of proximate cause, the lack of any injury that's traceable to this. But I think that one way or the other, it should fail as a matter of law. I just want to very briefly, if I may, address the statutory reporting, the negligence per se theory, to the extent that that is distinct. And I would note, Your Honor, that plaintiffs are waived and estopped because they concededly lumped this together with their other negligence theories that are concededly subject to Section 230. So to the extent they make this a distinct standalone argument, they are arguing contrary to what they argued in the district court. And in any event, this duty, too, arises solely from third-party uploading to websites for dissemination, and for the same reasons it would implicate Section 230. It's ultimately about what Twitter was allegedly doing as a publisher.
Can I drill down on the waiver or forfeiture argument that you're making?
Yes.
Are you saying, like, what are you relying on in the record to say that that occurred?
We cite it in our brief, Judge Forrest. It's basically, they said it should be analyzed together with the other negligence theories.
So that's in their briefing.
It's in their briefing in the district court. It's in
Correct.
Our brief that we point that out. I just don't have the exact record citation.
So in that same briefing in the district court, they also said, although these causes of action include a number of similar allegations and claims, each is premised on a separate and distinct theory. For example, in the cause of action of negligence per se, plaintiffs allege a different theory of negligence based upon a number of violations of various statutes. So I mean, I'm looking at that record and trying to make sense of, is there waiver going on there? It seems like that statement that I just quoted and the statement that you're referring to about just sort of look at them all together are somewhat contradictory. Why is that waiver?
I would say this. You know better than I the perspective of a district court judge. I read those briefs too, and my understanding is that these negligence theories would rise or fall together under Section 230, and the statutory duty simply establishes a standard, is how it dovetails with the others. And I would note that when these claims were dismissed, it's not like there was an effort by the plaintiffs to replead. They were invited to file an amended complaint with more specificity if they wanted to. They could have said, we meant to rest more on the distinctness. There was nothing like that, Your Honors, until they got up to this court. But even if you put that to the side, I'd say, as we were discussing earlier about the product design theory, there's no special duty that was owed to these plaintiffs and no proximate cause that's traceable to the reporting obligation, separate and apart from letting the objectionable content persist on the website. That's their harm. It's not about whether there was reporting to the federal government. In fact, the underlying sex trafficking or inducement or creation of the images had predated by years the supposed duty to report this. And so there's a total disconnect between reporting misconduct to the federal government and what ultimately aggrieves these plaintiffs, which is the failure to remove. My last point, Your Honors, is that Section 230 would be gutted, and CSAM would effectively be outside of it any time a plaintiff alleges it wasn't removed as soon as possible, because that is the statutory duty. The statutory duty is to report as soon as possible, as soon as it's known. So I think in the absence of a private right of action, Judge Sanchez, this court should be especially reluctant to open the floodgates for any private plaintiff who says that there was CSAM on there and it wasn't removed immediately to say they have a cause of action as a result.
I have one last question. It relates to the hashtags and the search functions. And if you could elaborate on how two cases we've had fit into this case or not, and that's the Dyroff case and yes. The roommates case.
Okay. For Dyroff, Your Honors, I think it does teach that the algorithms and the mere and Reddit teaches this too, the mere fact that popular content is treated as popular content is not a basis for overcoming Section 230 immunity. Roommates, an interesting case that Your Honor knows more about than I do, of course, but I would note, Your Honor, that as far out as roommates went to erode arguably Section 230 protections, it was very clear that there was affirmative conduct, I think, by the website that was apart from just letting third-party content passively remain there. The issue in roommates is that there was enforcement, essentially, of private choices that had been made by the third parties as to when they would engage in certain transactions. And the fact that roommates was the fact that the website, Airbnb, I believe it was enforcing that was a large part of the liability and creating affirmative content, actually creating the
putting
content.
Something in the box.
Exactly. Oh, and a portion of what then gets reflected on the website, which is different from saying what I think every website says these days, we're going to have certain rules about how content gets promoted and how it gets viewed and, you know, how advertising matches up with that. That's just how the internet works. If Your Honors have no further questions, I know I'm beyond my time. I appreciate the indulgence.
Thank you. All right, we'll put 3 minutes on the clock for rebuttal, and if questions take you beyond that, we will go beyond.
Thank you, Your Honor. Three things on rebuttal. First, what I'm hearing here when my friend says that the plaintiff's theory of harm is that there needs to be a removal is essentially a refresh of the but-for test that this court has repudiated repeatedly. And the focus, again, is square one. What is the legal duty? With regard to the product liability case, it's the fundamental legal duty to have a safe product and avoid foreseeable injury. With regard to the child pornography claim, it's the duty to not knowingly possess child pornography on these facts. That's clearly what the platform did. And with respect to the benefiting from sex trafficking claim, the legal duty is to not knowingly benefit. And I would urge the court to look at paragraphs 30 through 41 of the complaint, which explain the ways that Twitter or X benefits from content that's put on its platform. It's constantly monetized and cross-monetized. Second, with regard to the product liability claim, paragraphs 182 and 187 show that there is a focus on having a safe platform where injurious criminal images can be reported and reported quickly. Here I think, Judge Sanchez, it's okay to look at what the statute in 2228A and B say. It says as reasonably soon as possible, you know, the images need to be reported to law enforcement. And I think that informs Twitter's overall duty to the public, even though this is not a claim premised exclusively on that.
So I want to come back to that issue because, as I mentioned, I was a little bit confused by your answer in your first argument. I don't see a paragraph in the divine defect claim that relates to the duty for Twitter to report to authorities. How I read that is the design defect that you're alleging is for users to be able to more effectively report to Twitter. What am I missing?
Well, Judge, 182 talks about the overall safety structure. 187 also refers to the overall safety structure of the platform. And, of course, the paragraphs of the complaint are incorporated together for the holistic interpretation. We're here on a motion to dismiss. So the inferences need to be read in favor of these plaintiffs and not the opposite, as my friend has described with his waiver argument. Briefly, with regard to waiver, it's been discussed. I'm not talking about the negligence side, but I'm talking about the other areas where there's been some suggestion that there has been waiver. It's in the papers. But if the court would look at notes 1 in the Calise decision and note 16 in the roommate's decision, both of them make it clear that when a Section 230 claim is moving forward, it's an affirmative defense, and it's constantly the burden of the defendant to continue to maintain that. And finally, Judge McEwen, with regard to Dryoff and roommates, I think that's a helpful discussion. And in addition to what I've already said, I would just note that the Anderson case from the Third Circuit, which is something that we raised with supplemental briefing. This is the Third Circuit grappling with how a claim is to be viewed after the Supreme Court's decision in the Moody case. And we wanted the court to be aware of that because what the Third Circuit says in Anderson, which is a case against TikTok, is content curation decisions by a platform do not necessarily get swept up by Section 230 because that is something that the platform itself is speaking, and so it is something that it itself has responsibility for. And I think that fits with what this court has said repeatedly with regard to a material contribution. Are there any further questions? We appreciate the court's consideration of this. No company in America could behave with the knowledge that Twitter has here in such an overt way. We think the appropriate result would be a reversal and a remand with instructions to the district court to at least take into consideration the legal duties so we can move forward to discovery in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I thank both counsel for their helpful arguments. The matter of Doe versus Twitter is submitted.